by.
If anybody who's seen one of my lectures knows how rambling it is. Thank you. For the emphasis. I don't know how long I'm going to talk. I'm going to try to keep it fairly short, you know, half hour, 45 minutes. But interrupt if you have questions. I want this to transmogrify into the discussion. So, you know.
Can you spell that?
Yeah.
Nope.
A bad spelling. I can spell it wrong. You know. So first, what I wanted to talk about is kind of this subject of art education and how it relates to two other things. One is this thing that we're doing today, summer school, whatever the hell we want to call it. I've been calling it summer school. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we here? What does it do for us, or what can it do for us? Or why were we motivated to do it the first place? And then art practice in terms of on an individual basis. Like, how does art education and the models of art education interface with your own art practice and the kind of greater world, you know, the larger, the world at large. So I kind of wanted to look at first this. This is not something that I forwarded you guys, but it's something that some of my students have looked at, and maybe some of you guys have looked at this, a couple of these histories of education that have been published lately. One kind of really, an essay that caught a lot of people's attention is the Thierry Dedouve article, When Attitudes Become Form. And it was published in this anthology of art theory, like from 1985 to 2000 or the present or whatever the hell it was. And it kind of laid out the history of art education pretty nicely. And, you know, but obviously oversimplified from a particular perspective that, you know, may be problematic for us particularly because it was a European model. And I want to kind of run through his thing quickly so you kind of understand the kind of phases of the history of art education, at least one kind of understanding of it. This thing that I'm holding that I'm getting a few little bits of information out of is called A Primer on the Future of Art Schools. And it's a great little book. It was a symposium thing that Francis Stark put together in California at USC, was it? Yeah, USC, University of Southern California, in 2007, January of 2007. And you can buy this thing off of lulu.com. So you can go to Lulu, punch in Future of Art School, and this will come up in your search, and you can buy it. I think it's $18. You know Lulu? It's this online, on-demand publishing thing. It's a nice and interesting way to publish work and a way to find some interesting things, like people can make stuff like this available. The other interesting thing about this that they did was they basically just kind of took what was given them or what was available to them by the participants. Like, for instance, this is Dedouve's article, and it was basically just scanned right out of the book, and they left everything intact there. So there's no design to the book in that way, where the design is a lack of design. So whatever you see, everything's a different format. Stuart Bailey's in here, too. He's got this kind of much more crazy, a little weirder layout. But anyway, I'll backtrack, get back to the subject at hand. So Dedouve did this art education thing and kind of broke it into three nice, neat historical periods. How many people have read that essay in here?
Which one here?
It's the it's called When Attitudes Become Form. You looked at it?
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently I haven't assigned it recently.
Prepared work.
So, One, the first kind of in this history was the academy that he talks about, and this is, you know, the classic French academy. I don't know, it probably started in Renaissance and went up to around the Impressionists, right as modernism came in, the academy died, basically. You can still find the academy, there are still schools that teach that way, but they're utterly irrelevant to us, right? These things don't, they don't necessarily completely die out, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're dead.
So what is the academy?
That's what I'm getting. The academy is a way of teaching that stresses talent. So it's an inbred thing, like talent is what's important. You have it or you don't. And you can be trained as a painter, but if you don't have talent, you'll never be a really good painter. If you have talent, you'll be a really good painter. Okay? Technique is very important. And imitation. You know, this is a time period when people are painting other people's paintings. It's like, I want to redo that painting. And that was a completely legitimate standard operating procedure for painting, for instance. So this is the classic academy. You train under someone, you know, it's the apprenticeship model, that kind of a thing. With the kind of advent of modernism, this thing really starts to break down after the, especially after the Enlightenment. Once kind of romanticism enters into this, and modernism starts taking over in the, you know, somewhere between 1800 and 1860, this thing's dying off quick. It's quickly becoming irrelevant. And Dedue talks about the modernist. He calls this, because it's the classic example of a modernist art education, is the Bauhaus. Now, they weren't the first to kind of do this or stress this, but they're kind of the classical model for modernist art education. And that is they value creativity in a person. There's a kind of a beginnings of everybody can be an artist. You kind of foster creativity. Medium becomes what's important, like medium specificity. Like you investigate painting. You become a painter. You become a sculptor. And, you know, there are really good reasons for this to happen. Because if you think about what's happening in art, I talked about this with, you know, you guys are probably sick of me talking about the autonomy of art and how art basically loses its boss during this period. The church and the state no longer become important art patrons. So as an artist, you're on your own. You're now basically an entrepreneur. You don't have to answer to anyone. So what that is, it sounds great, but you also have to legitimate yourself. And the art as an institution has to legitimate itself, because it doesn't have the church telling it what's good and bad and important and not. It doesn't have the king or the monarchy or the duke doing that either. This is a big political change, and it changes the way art's made. So what ends up happening, I mean, if you look at the history of art, I like to show slides like, I don't know, some early Renaissance person, like, I don't know, name someone, an early kind of post-perspective person, painter, who knows art history. No, way earlier, like Giotto or a little after. If you look at like Giotto and then Caravaggio later and David even, you look at those things and they're different, but they're not that different. And then you look at someone like Manet, who's really starting to change things. I mean, all of a sudden paintings start to look a little different, and 6 years later, if that, you have Malevich's White on White. So painting goes from this really slow development to, in 60 years, you have a figurative painting that anyone would recognize to White on White, a white square on a white canvas. Why does that happen so quickly? It's because art loses its boss. It has to legitimate itself, and to do that, this Bauhaus model is like investigating the media. What the hell are we doing? What is painting? And one way to do that, of course, is like the classicist. Like, okay, what can we get rid of and still be a painting? We don't have to paint figures anymore. We don't have to, you know, we can just paint white on a canvas.
Yeah. This is kind of a little bit of a backtrack, but I'm not sure about something. It's like,
Between the transition between like the academy and then like the Bauhaus model, does that do away with the sort of notion? And I think it's more of a Renaissance thing, but I'm not really sure. It's like, does that sort of, the Bauhaus thing, does that sort of do away with the notion of like, there's like the one job that everyone is meant for, and like that's what they're supposed to do, like that sort of thing?
I would think so.
Oh, there's the cobbler.
Well, you know, the guilds go away
okay.
with that. I mean, that craft-based art changes really dramatically. You don't have guilds anymore. I mean, Bauhaus is interested in craft, but they're not interested in craft like they were in the Renaissance. It's not like you being a copper hammer, you know, or a saddle, a leather tool or something. Too bad Lane Rollier
is not here. Yeah, but doesn't it switch in the sense that you have the guild, but then you have the specialized. I'm a painter, and I'm thinking about painting my ideas.
Oh, yeah.
And so you are still, it's a switching of identity.
Okay.
In the sense that I am now in charge of this. It's still about painting. There's still a conversation that's being had.
Right, absolutely.
In relation to that. But it's not like, you're talking about like a job. Your
yeah.
job is a painter, but that's an artist. And that's
right, 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 right.
Well,
I just said that. I just like the reason I pointed that out is because I feel like that was sort of your cultural identity pre-modern.
With like cultural identity,
yeah,
it's a different issue. It is now.
A Renaissance, you were still considered a genius, but the idea of the artist as genius happened in France.
Right, but not all the schmoes. It's just like the guy who's like put his name on.
What was that?
Not the tradesmen, really, like, you know, it's like the head of the factory, so to speak.
Right,
yeah.
But I think that shift was like a really Renaissance thing, right? Like,
partly.
Crafts.
Yeah, but I think it shifted. My understanding, and I'm not an expert, is that it did change a lot then, but that it collapsed with modernity. Like, it was kind of a teetering shed that tipped over with modernity.
I think it was sort of that general shift, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's another way of looking at this stuff. Because I like to look at it from the autonomy of art perspective, but some people look at it from that craft and institutional perspective, and like other people like to look at it from the viewer's perspective, like how the galleries come into being at a certain point in time, like the 1700s or 1800s is like when the first galleries come, because art was private or it was in the church before that. You didn't go to the gallery because there wasn't any. If you were just a normal person, you saw art in a church, and that was it. Maybe a statue outside. The other thing that the Bauhaus is interested in, besides the medium, because this is a kind of a very logical way to kind of interrogate and legitimate your practice, is invention. You know, invention becomes important. How to do something new, how to do something that hasn't been done before. And that's really, you can easily see how that ties in with the medium thing and trying to figure out, you know, what's painting, what's sculpture. Dedoux goes on and talks about the contemporary kind of paradigm, which he, I think, thinks is wearing out, but he doesn't in the essay. Frustratingly, I think he's done a ton of work on what he thinks the next step is after this, but he doesn't play it out at all. He doesn't touch it in his essay. But the contemporary wearing out one, attitude is what's important, how you approach art. And you can see that this is classical. If you look into conceptual art, the attitude of how you approach something is incredibly important. The critical attitude is what makes art, you know. It's like your approach, your critical approach is what's important in making work. And you can still see that. And even if it's a worn out model, it still may be important to us. Even if the model is breaking down, that may be one element we keep. I mean, I kind of hope that's part of what we keep is our criticality. Practice, this idea of art practice comes into being. It's no longer about medium. You look at conceptual art people and they don't want to be painters or sculptors or whatever anymore, right? They want to be artists in a much more general term. Most of them. That becomes the important model. And this idea of deconstruction is important in terms of like how can you tear a work apart and analyze it. It's kind of I think this is in a sense looking at and looking like after the work is made. And the, you know, the DeJuve in his article really criticizes that because it, you know, we've all gone to this point. I just don't think it's necessarily bad, but the paralysis of deconstruction, like when you really like tear your work apart till it's tiny little crumbs and you can't do anything anymore because nothing's ever right.
Situation, sort of.
What's that?
Humpty Dumpty situation.
Well, you know, it's like you can't. There's no right answer, so you kind of get paralyzed because you can see the holes in whatever you make, and you know what you need to do is kind of understand that there are always holes in your work. And it's like, I don't know.
It's part of your job, and then it shifts from being just the artist to artist and critic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep, very important. I mean, those kinds of shifts in what you do as an artist or as a critic are really important, too. There's an interesting book that was just published, Sternberg. Did you see Canvases and Careers? It's Sternberg Press put it out, and it's basically a symposium thing. Johanna Burton and George Baker and... what's her name? The German woman. Can't remember her name, but there are a bunch of people in there that do some pretty interesting stuff about criticism, and Baker's essay is particularly interesting. He's trying to argue for an autonomy of criticism, which seems we mistakenly look at criticism as being in the service of art, and I think that's kind of the wrong way. So this is, those three things are the kind of real basic kind of breakdown of phases of art education history, just as a background. And I'm really interested in these kinds of ideas of models of education, because we can always see that, I'll talk about art practice a little later, but that how we approach art education, how schools teach people art.
So where do we talk about post-World War II and the United States?
Well, this is the interesting thing about this. These models don't work well for, like, DeDuve's thing is European. And
that's
it
right.
Comes to the U.S., but it comes to the U.S. later.
It's a different.
Well, and it sort of gets, yeah, it's, I don't know, depending on your position, I guess it gets faster than it's sort of.
Well, the problem is it's not, we don't have art education in this country until the early 20th century. And when we do, we're teaching teachers, not artists. Teachers teach art classes and take art classes when they're in school. If you want to become an elementary school teacher, you have to take art classes. And if you go take an art class, your class is filled not with people who want to be artists, they're filled with people who want to be teachers. And that's because the U.S. is, I mean, if you want to really read a really interesting essay, there's Andreas Huysen, you know this guy, H-U-Y-S-S-E-N, I think is his, how you spell his name. He's a German guy, but he's been in the States for a long time. H-U-Y-S-S-E-N, I think he is.
S-S-E-N?
E-N. He did this article called Searching for a Tradition in one of his anthologies. Has anybody read that one? It's a really fascinating article, essay, because it talks about half our problem with like this idea of recent history and U.S. history of art is that we mix up the term avant-garde. What is it? What are the two terms? Avant-garde and modernism we mix up. They're not the same thing. Like, avant-garde is different than modernism. And the U.S. doesn't have an avant-garde in the early 20th century. Because what the avant-garde depends on institutions to kick over, right? The avant-garde's job is to kick stuff over, knock stuff over. And we don't have museums in the early 20th century to knock over. Europeans had the avant-garde because they had this museum tradition. And we had Duchamp here, but he had nothing to break, you know. So it isn't until after World War II that we have an avant-garde, because finally we've accumulated this cultural capital that allows us to have museums and galleries and art institutions, and now we can go spit on them and kick on them, and now we can have an avant-garde. But the problem is that by that time, the Europeans are very cynical about the avant-garde, because they've seen it fail pre-World War II. It failed. So you have the European avant-garde, which is cynical and says essentially the avant-garde is dead. And then you have the U.S. 60s people who are like, ooh, this new avant-garde thing is so great and cool. You know, so there's a really different, and art education does that too. There's a guy who did a very widely read art education book, and I'm trying to find his name. Howard Singerman. I can't remember the name of the book off the top of my head. One of his essays is in this, and I think it goes over a lot of the ground that the book does, and I was just starting to read it. I don't know how far I got into it, 5 or 10 pages, called Excellence in Pluralism, and it talks about specifically, his book is on the MFA programs, like the history of MFA programs, but that's a whole other ball of wax. Like MFAs, you didn't have those until the 60s. Like I think the GI Bill like birthed the MFA programs.
You know? Hey, you guys are in a bad spot right now. You might have to get a PhD.
Yeah.
It is turning right now that you're going to have to go get an MA and then a PhD like
just
everybody
say
else.
No.
I know.
Say no.
It's the worst thing that's happened to it's just another way of taking more money from you guys.
Well, Europe, they do it. Basically, it's a very common thing in Europe.
As far as some of the artists I've talked to, they actually should be working artists before they can get into a program, which is very different than what we do. Mm-hmm. Did you come out of a school and go into a school? If you had to actually be a working artist, we would know that would cut half this room out right off the bat. Because any room would cut half the room out. Who's serious? Who's really serious?
Who gets interested in something else and does something else?
That's right. And so that they have a whole different practice mm-hmm. altogether. And the GI Bill put in institution, here's a ceramics class. Mm-hmm. Here's a printmaking class, right? I mean, isn't this what we're talking about in terms of we're still dealing with that?
Oh, I think we're totally. Well, we have a new GI Bill now. This is going to happen again because they're just passing this now, more education stuff for the veterans of, you know, the recent wars. And we're going to have a whole new kind of, which might be really good for us and might be really good for you because you might, there may be teaching jobs eventually for you when you get out of school.
More,
yeah. But then again, you might be a little too late. They may be snapped up by people my age who didn't get them the first round. And there may be none by the time you get your MFA or PhD. We'll see. We'll find out. So, you know, so there are these different models that education can be based on. And I kind of looked at these in terms of, again, if we looked at Dedube's very simplified history of education, and you look at the academy, you can kind of look at it as almost a handicraft type of thing, almost a craft-based thing. And it still was slightly tied to that. I mean, it wasn't exactly that because you did have the idea of the genius and things like that, and talent, which is very important because craft didn't really, I think, have that importance of talent. Craft was something to learn. And you could learn to paint, and you could become a good painter, but you couldn't become a great painter according to the academy unless you had this talent in you. There are other ways, like if you look at the Bauhaus, What model could that be? What could that be kind of modeling or imitating or mimicking in the greater world? And I was thinking it could be, you know, there are several kind of things. Research and development. Like if you were the research and development person for a factory or a company, that's kind of like what the Bauhaus was kind of trying to be too. You know, they're the R&D people in some ways. There are different ways you can think of art practice and art education as being kind of based on production or factory work or something like that. I mean, there's other interesting things to look at. There's this old movie that I think is, you might find a video in your school called Painters and Painting. And it, has anyone seen it?
Painters and Painting.
Yeah.
The New York one?
Yeah, and it's got like Barnett Newman, and it's got everyone from Barnett Newman to Larry Poons and Warhol, right? And it's absolutely fascinating. Like, it's got like lots of artists I'm not really at all interested in, but it's so interesting how they present themselves. like Barnett Newman's the intellectual, like he is like dresses in a suit, like he's like the professor type. And you get to someone like Larry Coons, and he's the worker. He's the worker. He's wearing boots. He's in this big, dirty warehouse space, you know. And then you get Warhol, who's like the next model. You know, he's not the worker anymore. And it's like, it's really amazing, because if you think about that history, how compressed that is. It's incredibly compressed. Because that history is kind of, you could see that as being like, the Renaissance was artist as professor. And the work, you know, maybe the avant-garde was more like the work, the worker or something. And then Andy Warhol was like this postmodernist or post-World War II thing. But it happens in this country. It's completely perverted because of our compressed, our lack of an early 20th century avant-garde. So, you know, it happens like, we have to go through that history. Quick, people, run through that history quick so we can move on and catch up. But then this third thing, this idea of the contemporary, where the attitude is important, this critical attitude, this idea of an art practice instead of being medium specific, and this idea of deconstruction, what's that modeled after? And one could be, you could think of the service industry, right? Because we get into the service industry where we're no longer producing things, but we're providing services. You could also think about it in terms of information technology. Because this is today, it's been going on for a while, but information becomes a whole industry, and what industry becomes, a lot of industries become based on. I mean, there's a very famous conceptual art show, I think it might have been at MoMA, called Information. It was in the 1970s, this big show called Information. And of course, this is a little before, I mean, we were, I think business type and economists were, maybe just some of them were just thinking about this kind of idea of the information economy. So we have all these kinds of new ways of thinking about our economy. And these things bounce around. Like, we, just because you're in an art institution doesn't mean we're inventing our own models. We're getting them from other places. And I don't want to say it's a one-way street, but, you know, these things, these institutions and the way we kind of structure institutions and the way we do things get reproduced socially over and over and over again. So the way you work becomes maybe the way you also live your life. You know, the family model is important too, the industrial model, and how you, what kinds of jobs you do in that kind of thing. So I'm really interested in those kinds of, how these models happen. This idea of excellence too. I mean, this is what's happening now, and we've heard it for a while. How many people, I mean, teachers, how many times do you hear the word excellence come out of your university PR people? I mean, that's like the nails on a chalkboard to me now.
Excellence. Well, it's like Aristotelian. I mean, that's like 3,000 years
ago. No, but you have to quantify it.
No, but the problem with excellence is it's an absolutely empty term.
Yeah, no, it is. I agree.
Aristotle had a meaning for it, right?
Well, yeah, I know. But I mean, in terms of like the idea, I mean, like you're saying, that has more to do with Renaissance culture or pre-Renaissance culture.
This stuff is like the contemporary. Like,
right, no, but it's PR people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You're not hearing that from your teachers and crit. They're not like, yeah. A lot of excellence.
I think, you know, that stuff does start to filter. I mean, the brainwashing does start to take hold, you know, and kind of work its way into the classroom eventually.
So, Aaron, I got a question for you.
Uh-huh.
How do we determine mastery? Are we interested in it anymore? Using these academic models.
Mm-hmm.
And you use the word excellence, but let's use the word mastery.
Like a master painter?
Yeah, master work. Work of art. Master. Do we value that anymore in education? Do we think that's a fallacy? What do you think with the models we're looking at?
Well, it depends what you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about something that's like an artist is a master of their medium, that's uninteresting, I think, to most people who are relevant.
I think like the owners were afraid to go there because there's some uncomfortable PC connotations. Like, you cannot call anything in that way. way better than something else. You know what I mean? I would have to start to consider all these social factors. It's like, how dare you consider
the word master?
But I think there are two different problems there, though.
Maybe, yeah.
And I think there's one that there's all the problems tied up with genius and the critique of the genius and that idea, like the genius was used to like
or original
keep your thumb on other people.
Totally, yeah.
And then there's the idea of what you're talking about, like this, like getting rid of value judgments.
Right.
To me, it's sort of like
talk to Michelle about that. That drives her crazy.
To me, it's sort of like an excess of like subjectivity. That's like an enlightenment runoff that we haven't been able to like shake.
What kind of?
Like, so it's just like an excess of subjectivity where you're like, oh, I can't say this because he thinks differently than I do. So
Which is a funny thing, it puts us at odds, I think, like with maybe something that's essential about what we are, artists, we're called upon to make that judgment at a personal level on every single thing we touch. And if you can't get behind it, it kind of goes to what you're saying about I can deconstruct something until I have nothing, and I'm in the same place again, like, you know.
Bruce, I think it's this. The word mastery is construed with crap.
Yeah,
I think you have to separate the two of those ideas. And maybe they come together in certain places.
Or at the very least, like, knowledge of like the different sorts of traditional formal things that are available. You know, it's like a poet that knows all the packages or something.
I think part of the
I was just going to say, we still use the term, it's just been professional. I think that's one of the other things that's killed it, that as long as you follow the path of the fact that you are a master.
Master's fine art.
But the other thing is, the idea of mastery, Joe, this is the question. The idea of mastery implies you're master over something, and what the hell is that thing?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that it used to be was a medium or a craft or something, and we got rid of that a while ago. So
if I say master work, that still implies a craft.
At the Bauhaus, they do have that, like massive metals.
That's different. That's a profession.
Well, yeah, but that still goes like.
I'm talking about the Mona Lisa.
I mean, it's still
yeah, like to me, like the significance of like master over.
Well, masterwork was the same thing. It was a one piece you spent like 2 years on that defined you as an artist. Yeah.
The piece.
But it's the same thing.
You're talking about like, in your opus or something like that.
So that's how you went out in the world as your
own. Yeah. I think that the whole artist is the modernist thing. Yeah, for sure.
Someone else, jump in.
Well, I was just going to, I feel like master and masterpiece are mean different things. Masterpiece has more than just a technical thing.
Right.
It's also about the new idea that it brings or something.
Well,
like what
do you mean, like historically or for the artists themselves? Or both, I guess.
I'm not sure. I guess I'm just thinking about the words like now.
By the way,
I think like if you say a master
just so you know, the fact that you even said that means you don't get it. Because it's not about you. Masterpiece is so beyond the time that you're in, it goes beyond you.
So no one knows what you're
doing. Okay, so like you're sort of an object
really
for your masterpiece.
You're
decide, right?
Sorry.
You decide, right? Over time, right. I think, and that masterpiece is something that's also you can't quantify in any way because it's some quality, it's ability over years and years to move, to touch, and create thought in individuals' minds. And so masterpiece, you're right, we do decide over time, and it's almost like we don't even have to consciously decide. It's going to decide for us. And those people have absorbed it, looked at it, thought about it because it's mysteriously compelling, you know, maybe because of its craft or other things. I think some of the other things.
Can we talk a little bit about that, what you said earlier about, like, Michelle gets really worked up about this, like, getting rid of value judgments? And, like, how is that related to, like, not having any control over knowing if you can make a masterpiece or not? That do we just, like, get, we're just like, oh, we don't know, so we should just make whatever and not worry about.
Yeah, I mean, after I go back to what Joe said, like, the masterpiece is a thing beyond you, you know, like, maybe created by an individual, a group, or something like that, but it is kind of beyond you.
We're talking about the term you ways.
Yes.
There is the just purely the definition of masterpiece, which is this thing that you make to be a master. And you go through a process which has a big change.
And then there's like,
the cultural definition.
Like the more pedestrian, the master's piece. Master made this.
I agree that other people sort of choose the masterpieces thing, but I think it is still really caught up in sort of like the individual as an artist.
I think it is in some ways too, historically especially.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a contradictory thing, I think, because I think there are, I mean, basically whatever came off of Da Vinci's easel was a masterpiece because it was Da Vinci. You know, there's that type of masterpiece. You know, I think it was Linda Knopfler who talks about the development of the map, of the masterpiece is something that's out of your hands. You have to kind of survive your era. Like, the work has to survive your era and, like, move on and remain relevant.
So is there contemporary masterworks right now?
No. According to her, you would say no because, and this is the reason, too early. You don't know what survives. You don't know what survives.
You could be wrong. Of course you're wrong. But you're going to say that the Mona Lisa was not valuable in her time. And I would say that's still a masterpiece.
Definitely not the case.
But by definition, it can't be a masterpiece during its time. If you define masterpiece that way, it's true, because that's the definition of masterpiece.
Sure.
And that would be her point. Like, you can think it's a masterpiece and you can think it's a great work, and it can be a great work for its time. But you don't know. It's like the boundary. Like, you don't know that far ahead of time. You may think and you may be very good at predicting these things, but you can't predict the future.
Well, I'm just talking about it in general. I mean, we're talking about, you know,
their entry into much art or their art education were who was told that they were good drawers.
It's like, yeah, raise your hand. In high school, right? Raise your hand high if you were a good drawer in high school and you should go into art school.
I mean, that's where
in my stomach.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that's where the value is put. It's on the craft of the master, or the, like, it's what is good. And I get students so many times, it's like, yeah, they were told that they were drawers, and that's why they. I was so happy to see the philosopher. Was it philosophy or? That entrance into the art world, and I think that's where I'm excited. It's like a lot of this room is just like, it feels like it's a different era.
That's interesting for me too. Like, I'm sort of going through like a reverse of that. Like, the art world was sort of an entry into like philosophy and stuff like that for me.
I wonder if it's American or if it's. I mean, because I know like Europeans don't have like prom queens and prom kings. They don't pick the best students out of it. You know what I mean? They don't celebrate it that way.
Well, I think at least from what I know of like universities and stuff there, I think it's more of a trial by fire thing. It's like, well, they don't have to do that because they just see who lasts. And like that would be the way where they're like, for us, everyone goes to college. It's like, oh, I'm done with high school, I go to college. You know?
You're saying that Europeans don't go to college at all?
Not everyone. They're even more avid with like standardized tests than we are. But each college has its own standardized tests or like multiple ones, depending on what you're going into.
I would say they have more opportunity.
I think a lot of Scandinavian countries definitely, I would say that. From what I know of like France, Spain, Italy, it's like they have a part where like, you know, they go into the academia or university and then the rest of them sort of go to like this trade school and like learn a trade.
Well, it used to be that way in Germany, and I don't know what it's like now, but it's way before college, right? You get funneled into one of three different systems, and they lead either to university or to this or to the other.
You know, Aaron, the reason I brought up mastery is because it's about, you know, we're not talking about discipline in the sense that we're going to train you as a painter, but we still do that.
Right.
And the question I had was because I'm thinking about how we go in and what our expectations are and how we as teachers try to, you know, move through the system now. Because you're talking about this new model, this contemporary model. And if it's about, contemporary model is about what again? It's about celebrity, or it's about, you know, are we teaching that?
Yeah.
Is that what we're trying to teach?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, is that what we're gonna do? Because we're maybe not necessarily teaching craft anymore, but I still want that discussion.
To a trouble.
You mean like the right style sort of thing?
Well, I'm actually wondering about teachers. Who are we teaching that? Is that what we're trying to do?
We're way invested in that, I think.
Yeah,
no, how many of us all know the same fucking hipster artists that everybody's reading about this year? You know what I mean? Like, all of us, it's good to watch it, man. It's scary. But something funny going on there. We all know the same shit. I was thinking, like, how, you know, I'm making a lot of weird crap now. But how I got into weird stuff was through, like, fucking Otto Dix or some shit like that. Do I say, I mean, I do, but I don't feel like a lot of my colleagues do. People talking about Otto Dix or, like, someone that was on the cover of our forums, like, oh, make sure all the kids talk about that. We'll talk about that, you know? It's like, you're teaching garbage hipsterism into a disturbing level. It's a disturbing level. We gotta watch it as artists, man. You gotta watch that shit.
Taking references like that and then seeing all the teachers.
Right. Have you seen Zonzo?
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, oh, yeah, you were in that same class. Oh, I was in that class.
Because we have to do that. I think we have to have that conversation about what's current, what's interesting. That's exciting, that's cool, but
our activity is
not...
You don't want to get too
excited. Yeah.
I agree. I'm really, 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 really worried about that.
As teachers, where do you feel like that pressure is coming from? Like, is it from the school that you work for, or is it from your peers, or...
I don't think it's pressure at all. I think it's just we're in the conversation. And I think that while in some cases where Bruce is talking about we're teaching hipsterism, we're also saying, hey, listen, we're engaged in what is going on right now. I want to talk to you about some of these new ideas, too, that are coming out. So there's a little bit of both.
There's a little bit of both.
Yeah, for sure.
There's some competitive stuff, too. There's this kind of underlying, do you know this person?
Oh, yes.
You don't know this? You should really look at them, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, oh, God, I better go and look at these, because this is people are looking at.
Right. Well, let me give you an example is, I get the opportunity, more than most of it, I get to talk to MCAT students, you know, kind of regularly for the very, and I'm always surprised what people don't know. They only know the new. And they haven't tracked their practice back far enough.
Right.
And that's your job.
It's like the unmonumental group of work that fell out of thin air. Like all of a sudden, like, you know,
but that's
there's
kind
no
of history. Yeah.
Yeah. And who are they looking at? Because I trust artists to a great degree, and I know those artists are looking at other things.
That's right.
Yeah.
But what's changed ultimately, I think, is just the structure of the artwork. Like, there's pressure coming from anything. It's the fact that there is so much art out there right now.
Sure.
And it's changed after that never was the case like 60 years ago.
That's right.
Every single artist in the world, you're closely watching everyone's work.
Yeah.
Well, that's staying up on it right now. There are a lot more artists than there used to be. And the art crash or the art boom, too, is going to change things. Because, boy.
Well, it changed the first time, right? Tiny paintings, like, you know, Elizabeth Pagan were actually important.
Uh-huh. Well, there was such an obsession with youth. And, you know, two, three years ago.
And younger than Jesus?
Yeah, exactly. That show was put together 2-3 years ago, you know.
Right.
And it came, you know, it's like the wrong, you know. I mean, we knew it was wrong in a way, but now the economy's saying, wrong, we don't care about you either, you know. It's like, we're having a collapse.
Well, that's why I feel like I love seeing like The Quick and the Dead. That's such a happy show for me. I'm filled with love feelings about art, being an artist. It's because it just abandons that bullshit.
And it makes connections.
It makes connections.
Historical connections.
Yeah.
Formal connections.
Right.
Well, do you think that we're making art about art? Because you were saying that no one knows what art is anymore. We're all entrepreneurs, so we're kind of looking to one another and then history to figure out what are we going to master? What is fine arts? There's no clear definition.
Well, there's a really, I mean, I think it's still kind of relevant. You know, Lyotard did that What is Postmodernism essay that everybody read 15 years ago. But it was, you know, there's still something important that he said in there art is undefinable because it's making its own definition. Like, you're not following rules, you're making rules.
So do you think that stems us into constantly talking about artists? Is that why? Why is that why we're name dropping all the time? You know what I'm talking about.
I think there's something.
Well, sort of unavoidable. You know, I mean, a lot of people make that out to be like more pretentious than it is. I think actually, it's like a bunch of buddies getting around and talking about like basketball.
I agree.
It's
like no difference.
It's
what we're into.
Yeah.
It's weird. And it's important. You need to know that stuff. It's interesting.
It's partly important because if you're going to have a conversation, I can, say Jeff Koons, and I don't have to say much more than that. Uh-huh. And there was like more language that just got.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's just
like,
pushed out.
You don't have to read the magazine article.
So what do you think is like the best way to avoid being obsessed with like the celebrities that are? Like, it's a lot more.
I think you have to look back too. You have to see what's going on today, and you have to say where the hell is that coming from? Because it's coming from someplace. No one's the first person to do
that. And you kind of want to find that little nugget of joy in history that got left behind.
Too. Absolutely.
Ideally, part of what you're like your job as art students is to find your own history, figure out the part of what your work is.
If you have not been broken of this, if you have not been broken of disillusion, I'll break it now. You're not being educated by art school. You're being taught to kind of do your own education. And I don't think that's a bad thing. That's just a necessary thing. That's like the state of the situation that's been going on for a long time. I think if you went to the best school in the world, you'd kind of be educated. They would kind of educate you, but we're basically giving you like a net with enormous holes in it, and that net's going to catch some crap in it, but you have to like fill in that net so you can get more crap.
Well, we have talked about this.
You have to fill in the gap.
We were talking about the sense that how you teach at MCAT, how Chris teaches at the University of Minnesota is maybe a little different than the way Bruce and I get an opportunity. Because we get to see people from freshmen to seniors. I've been able to track someone for 4 years, maybe 2 years if they came in later, and I know where the holes are, I know where the cracks are, I know where the net isn't full, and I get a chance to help them out. Now, if you're at a bigger institution or an art college, you can slip through, because you might get Chris, you might get Eric if you knew who he was, then you might try to take every class.
But then it becomes more of a responsibility on our part to track them.
Well, then we're talking about like apprenticeships,
maybe.
And so I'm just saying, like, we get this different opportunity, and so when I see Chris and I go, dude, I don't know how to navigate that. Yeah. Like, you get a class and you get a one shot at some people, like one shot. Maybe they're interesting, maybe they're not. How do you know?
Yeah, you kind of have to figure them out, right? Like, you may not see that person again, and I'm kind of in the same situation. Like, this is my one shot at this person. As a student,
I have sculptors that's pretty broken down in different departments that are at the school. But I'll meet a senior and they say, "Oh, what do you do?" And I'm a sculptor. It's like, where were you?
Yep, I have that happen every once in a while at MCAT. Like where someone graduates and I look at their work and I'm like, "Wow, that's really good. Where the hell were you?" You know, they took critical phase of someone else.
Well, here's a question for Matt. Matt, you were never an art student. You're a music major, and you took one semester, so you really haven't had an art education like the rest of these people. How do you see yourself navigating being an artist or talking about, like, because we're talking about education in a sense,
talking about history of education, but we're also talking about how to be educated as an artist. So what do you think?
You don't have a net, you have a string.
A roll. Yeah.
It's all right, you can catch things.
What's the next
thing? What about
you get the access?
I guess I really don't care about this conversation.
For the most part.
Like, I guess, okay, so we're talking about how art essentially reiterating itself, or at some point it becomes self-reflexive in some sense of lineage. Roxy Aaron actually has really great book on this, and
what's the work?
Politics of Image is one of the big ones, and then there's Aesthetics and Politics also.
Oh, I actually have that essay. I haven't read it yet, though. Awesome.
It's actually a book.
Oh, it's a book?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This must be something different.
But I don't think you're...
I was just going to say, like, and his premise of Aesthetics and Politics is that your work as an artist is ultimately self-reflexive, but how it reiterates itself or how it reifies itself is an art on a different thing, but that is always changing, and that's always the thing that's consistent. So it's mutually consistent and mutually inconsistent as it's consistent.
Okay. I got you. So,
but you're still going through a path of being an artist, and that while you don't have a teacher to talk to every day, you're still trying to create a conversation, you're still looking at artists. It's not like you're doing a different work.
Right. But I'm talking more in the lineage of art between separate artists.
To dismiss the rest of this conversation is almost to argue for your own autonomy.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'm just not so, because I haven't had art. Which is totally different. You're talking about the academy with music. Like, that's considered a Freudian education or something like that.
Still considered a relevant model in the new world,
right?
That's kind of great for you because you have the potential to do something like really interesting. So you just got your feet wet with the whole institutionalized art thing.
No, but what I would argue is before you say that, because that could easily be a dismissive statement. Which is, oh, wouldn't it be great if I'll be young and new again and just try and be the first, right? And naive. But I would say that the work that's going on isn't necessarily coming from a teacher. And so there is an open opportunity for yourself and your exploration. And maybe music helped that, or maybe some other way. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't mean, I guess that came out as rude by saying I'm not interested in the product. maybe it's my attitude.
A bit of critical attitude.
I think so. One, we're talking about, even you look at the British schools, like right after the GI Bill, Liam Gillick has an article about this, in saying that at the 80s, with Goldsmith and that whole education system, was the first time there's a distinction between the post-war and the new, and that's why he's different as this UK artist or something in his nationality and not a world object, the world and things like that. Whereas opposed to getting this kind of he looked at it as a distraction of the future class.
Distraction.
And
education?
Art education. Because you have things like let's look at the Yardbirds, like someone like that where they're all art students. And you got Clapton
TV. Right, you had to.
You look at every UK from that period, it's all about this attitude. Mm-hmm. But this is actually a totally different conversation, but still had that critical aspect of this is a really rigorous conceptual thing, but I'm still having this exchange of I want to fuck that. I want to be really aggressively against that. And you're developing an attitude that's still critical of that model.
Do you feel not tainted?
How would I know?
Right? That's what I guess I was.
But you're looking to go into this situation now.
Yeah, I mean, eventually grad school sounds ideal. What do you mean by? I guess I don't understand that.
No, I just had the feeling that felt like you were not tainted by it.
Oh.
We're all involved.
I don't know.
It
me and Steve do now.
Yeah. It seems like you're someone, just in your work, it seems like you know an actor's history.
Well, and I would say, like, that's how it steps outside the model of artist education. Like, that's how really generous people, like, I mean, well, obviously, my friend, like, John Rasmussen, he's been very generous, and, like, that's weird. It doesn't even, like, he hasn't even fall off or just, like,
hey, I think you're arguing that, Aaron, that, and that's what I was trying to get at, which is that our best hope is to give you guys some tools and for you guys to not get lazy and do something with them. Because it's easy to play artist and play the student as much as I can play the professor. Don't you? You have to understand that these are jobs and roles. And there are a lot of art professors, and maybe I wouldn't put myself outside of that. It's an easy thing to do, and you get a model, and you don't realize that time is passing, and all of a sudden your model hasn't changed.
You can teach the same thing over and over and over again. Same dusty notes.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not fresh and it's not interesting, but I would say that the students are all the same. And the question I had when I was talking to Luke on the way up was, when I go to different schools, why do I see a minimalist person? Why do I see this staunch feminist? Why do I see, I mean, like, you guys are caricatures. If you go through, you go, oh, there's the guy that appropriates stuff and puts it on the floor. Mm-hmm. There's the tight, clean painting. There's going to be some kind of portrait. I mean, we see these models, and you guys haven't changed. But you're not, it's a different name. Right? But I see it. I've been seeing it for 8 years, and I walked through any, that includes Chicago Art Institute, that, you know, St. Cloud, it doesn't matter where it is. You guys, so somehow we're teaching models of behavior.
Well, but that's a really complicated question because, you know, as an artist, you have, you know, we like to think we're completely like, free.
Yeah, they do.
Well, but we're not. You know, we have certain things that, there are certain things you know, if you do them, you can do them in theory, but they won't be accepted. So you can't really do them. You do have roles and things, boxes that are acceptable. And it's like bending and twisting them. But if you break them, you know, you pay for it.
Aaron, do you think that's our laziness?
No.
I'm just putting it out to us.
But I think this is again, I mean, there's a fantasy of freedom that we have, especially in this country. Like,
sure.
Man, I'm an artist. Yeah.
I'm
going to do the weirdest thing ever.
Yeah, and that's how you get overly shocking or overly political art.
Yeah, but you do it in very specific ways. You know, it's not shocking because, you know, it looks like everything else.
Yeah.
It's shocking because it's graphically sexual or...
Or threatening.
Or what?
Red. Red.
The problem with this is, I don't know if I can give an example because, you know, the classical... The kind of thing that people have talked about is, you know, we're in and out, we can't see, we don't have this kind of bird's eye view of what we're doing. So we can't, it's very difficult to critique. And maybe if we thought about it long enough, we could come up with some examples. I don't know if I can write out
some of that. Would you say, like, let's say you're an institution that's really biased towards minimalism, like something like that, and like, you know, something that's outside of that box? Like, you mean like it's like breaking the box with a certain demographic?
No, because I think what happens is if you're breaking one box or going against it, you're just in another box.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
I mean, that's like there are pigeonholes and you pick certain pigeonholes. And this is oversimplified, but it's, I think you have to watch out for that kind of a thing.
This is sort of an interesting conversion thing with the thing Bruce was talking about being afraid to like declare yourself as anything at all, where you like your work and you sort of, you know, they come together and become nothing. And you were just talking about, like, how that sort of bird's eye